Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Welcome aboard, and we appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with us live and you are so inclined, you can scroll down to the bottom of the page. That's where we have the chat room. If you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or you got a flash of brilliance and a question you would really like for us to ask, that's a perfect place to do it. Right now we've got Paul and Steven and Byron are there in the chat room to keep you company. And if you got to run off halfway during the show to go take care of some business, remember, if you don't already, you can subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes, or Spreaker, or any place else, and you can catch up on what you missed on the show, and for that matter, any other previous shows we have done. And diving into the topic of today, this will be kind of fun. As I was talking in the pre-show with our guest, he and I started talking a few months ago about coming on the show, and you know, life happens, and you come back and loop around to it, and sometimes creative procrastination pays off because you talk about being timely with the news. I think we've got it right here because what we're going to talk about today is looking at a situation where for decades there's been peace and relative stability with a few exceptions in Europe, and all of a sudden from the east we have armies massing on borders. The diplomats getting nervous, friends getting quiet, acquaintances trying to get friendlier, but we're not talking about 2022. What we're looking at is 1987, and we're going to look at the end of the tail end of the Cold War. If you look at it sideways, squint, and if a couple of other players had moved into different positions than they did, we could have very easily had an alternate history. And our guest is somebody who has spent the last half decade looking at that alternative in detail. He's Michael C., and we're going to dive today into the research and tools in wargaming and the art of creating alternative historical fiction based upon his blog, World War III, 1987, that looks at in a detailed way what a hypothetical Third World War set in 1987 would look like. Michael is a retired U.S. Air Force officer and an all-around interesting fellow. Mike, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm really glad to have you on, especially here. Depending on who you talk to, we got a couple of interesting weeks ahead of us to see whether we're going to have a balk or somebody's actually going to come up to the plate and hit a firm pitch or not. And folks that have looked at the show page, they've got a link to your blogs, plural. And I know some of them, especially I know at least one person in the chat room that's read it. But if you could, your blog, World War III, 1987, you started it in 2017, and it's still going, and some interesting developments have come out of it. I thought I'd just back up for a minute when things weren't as focused on Russia and the threat in the East and Europe back in 2017. Talk a little bit about the genesis that got you to say, you know, here's something that needs a fresh look, and I want to dive into it.
Sure. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there. There really wasn't anything fresh, you know, as far as fiction or, you know, even games at that point, you know, for a World War III based back in the late 80s, you know, something along the lines of maybe the Red Storm Rising timeline. So that was kind of, it seemed to me that it was just kind of forgotten. And it's always been a topic that's been of significant interest to me. So I just decided to, you know, just take it and run with it and see where, you know, where it led.
When you decided to do this blog, I mean, you started out, but I noticed early on you mentioned Red Storm Rising and some other fiction from about that time. I mean, I assume there were a lot of, I think, Ralph Peters, Sir John Hackett, a bunch of other folks kind of discussed what could happen. Did you review all that stuff before you started doing this or as you were going? Because, I mean, I'm fascinated by the amount of work you must have put into this work.
Oh, sure. Thanks. As far as those books go, I mean, I've read them multiple times since back in the late 80s. As a matter of fact, I first picked up Red Storm Rising when I was about 10 years old. And to be fair, I didn't quite understand it as well as I did, you know, down the line a little bit, but that's what kind of got the fire going. But yeah, during the whole process, the last half decade, I've gone back to those works sometimes just to see how they covered maybe a certain, you know, a certain aspect or maybe a battle, maybe a lead up to a battle, and, you know, use it as best I could, their example. So sometimes I'd go back and look at some of the examples from their writing, and I would say, you could have done it better. Or this has to be a little, you know, improved a little bit before I put it into the blog. So,
you know, obviously there's everything from, I mean, to doing a project like this, especially for as long as you have, and some of the details, and it'd be funny if I could share everybody's screen here, is as I was reading your blog, I had your main page up on the far left tab, and on the right tab, I'd always right click, because for those that have read the blog, is you can have, you know, D plus 11, you know, part 1, 2, 3, and you read them serially,
right.
And so I'd right click on, and then I have 3 Google Maps up because I'm a map geek. It's like I would have, you know, Norway up on one end, I'd have North Germany and another, and the Denmark borders. I'd have the area around the Folda Gap and another, and I had the other for when you're going other parts around the world, because you name names, you name places, especially those that have been in the profession and have maybe spent some cold, wet weekends around them. It's kind of a nice little time travel from that point of view. And it's clear that when you progress forward and you outline this, it's not something that you can really freeform off the top of your head well, because as you and my co-host and I all know, anybody that's in the military sphere, God forbid you misidentify a certain variant of a platform.
Exactly. Yep.
You get a pound wrong. You know, this isn't a motor rifle division. This is a tank guards army, whatever. So you got to make sure that you get every detail right, or you're going to get told about it 1,000 times.
Oh,
talk about
absolutely.
some of the references and some of the tools you use, because as an Air Force officer, you know your area pretty well and the stuff to the left or righty pretty well, but just like everybody else in the service, the further you get away, the fuzzier the details can get. So I'm just curious, what type of ready access tools did you have to stop you from getting a bunch of annoying emails?
Well, before I do that, I just want to mention, because you were talking about maps, one of the readers from my blog, I don't know his screen name offhand, but he went and used Google Maps to create a map that showed every location of every battle, every location pretty much that I mentioned in the blog. And he went and he took it and he put it all together on one map. So from Norway all the way down to Saudi Arabia, he has all the labels of everything that pretty much happened in the blog. So I think that was – I was really impressed. I was really taken aback when I saw that, and that really meant a lot to see that. And it was actually helpful later on because I could reference that, you know, for some things I may have forgotten through the writing. Location names, you know, where units were positioned, things like that. And it was helpful. But as far as the sources go, gosh, there's so many. I mean, just everything from digital maps to a lot of research was put into it. And to be honest, the research is still going on, you know, as each as each new post comes out, you know, I'll go back and check certain things and make sure everything is, you know, online the way it should be. But, God, the amount of research that I've used, a lot of books from that time period, you know, on military, the Cold War military balance, air forces, navies, things like that, they were pretty useful. And as far as maybe today, I'm trying to think how to put it, a lot of digital reports and things like that from various sources, think tanks, combatant commands from back in the day, war colleges, of course, the Naval War College, Newport's archives were really helpful with that. So that kind of just to give you a little example, those are some of the areas where I did a lot of research, and I found a lot of useful information that I've kind of used in the blog over the last half decade.
I noticed you also you referenced in some of your blog posts that you'd use some computer games, I guess. That's probably not the right word, but computer simulations. I know that Harpoon gets mentioned, but I think you also have another one with Command.
Command, yes.
Air and Sea, or Sea and Air, whatever that is. Talk a little bit about how you use those to help you figure out what you're going to be doing with this with these blog posts.
Sure. Well, from the beginning, I modeled the conflict before I did anything else. So as from May of 2017 through maybe September of that year, I was writing the pre-war, things that were happening in the pre-war period, buildup of tensions, mobilizations, things like that. So while that was going on, I started to game out the conflict, and it took me a little while to find out which platforms were going to be best, you know, as far as games go and things like that. But once I did, Harpoon and Command were just the absolute best for air and naval. I was able to pretty much recreate, you know, not recreate, but pretty much create the air war over Germany just using Command. I was able to use the entire war in the North Atlantic from day one until the last day using Command. So it's just a very powerful game. It gives you a huge database, and it gives you a lot of options to use. And if you use them right, you can really model an entire conflict just using air and, on the air and sea side. You know, you can model an entire conflict to use it.
Well, didn't you also do some? You had to do some creative stuff on your own to get the information you wanted through the computers. You can kind of talk about that in your blog too. But can you sort of discuss that now?
Oh, sure. I'm trying to think. The best way just to put it. You know, I had to do a lot. Are you talking about on the research side or on the gaming side?
Well, I'm a little confused. Because it was a while ago that I read the notes you were making as you went along. But you were talking about how you had to do some research. You had to figure out a way to sort through the information so it'd be usable to you. And you were doing your own. I'm not quite sure, databases, whatever you were doing to make it work for you. And it sounded very very time-consuming.
Oh, yeah.
and very intriguing.
That was. That really was. And that's pretty much what it was. It was just a database of information that I had to sort through to figure out what was going to be relevant and what wasn't going to be. You know, for example, the orders of battle for 1987, I needed those from pretty much every NATO and Warsaw Pact nation. But there were aspects of it that I wasn't going to need. So I had to go in and try to separate the wheat from the chaff and figure out what was going to be useful and what wasn't going to be. And that went for strategies, doctrines, weapons, everything like that. You know, everything from loadouts of aircraft in 1987 to exercises that were being run around the time that the pre-war buildup was starting. So I'd have to figure out what units were going to be going where, you know, what naval assets were going to be available. You know, was the USS Kitty Hawk, for example, well, was that going to be in the Pacific? And if it was, I can't use it in the Atlantic. So I had to kind of go back and chart the history of a lot of those ships and a lot of those units. That was time consuming. But at the same time, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, the One thing I really liked about the beginning of it, you know, one of my little hobby horses I like to get on in a variety of ways is people or policy. Is you can have, you have nations, you have people, you have equipment, you have technology, but none of that really goes anywhere or does anything without people and their agendas and their power blocks and what their power blocks, motivations and worldviews, and how that can really steer the course of history. And it almost seems like a punchline to a joke that, you know, behind everything in Russia, there's a Romanov, but, and I'll have a follow-on question about this too, if it doesn't come out naturally, but one thing I liked about the fact is it's also helpful if the listener hasn't started going through the blog, is in addition to the other tabs, another tab that's helpful to have open is a Google or a DuckDuckGo or even a Wikipedia to look up some actual people. You use real people, real people who existed in history. And if you could please, on the Soviet side, talk about what happened to Gorbachev and who winds up in his place instead.
Sure. Well, on the Soviet side, there was a coup. And instead of 1991, this one was set in spring of 1987. Gorbachev was deposed, and he was pretty much exiled. He'll die later on. There'll be more about that in the blog, probably coming up in the next month. The man who took over was Grigory Romanov, and he was a hardliner. I mean, just he was cut from the same cloth as Andropov and, you know, people from that era. He wasn't a very big fan. I mean, obviously, he wasn't a big fan of Gorbachev. And in fact, when Gorbachev became the general secretary, he pretty much threw Romanov off the Politburo. So there's the motivation, really, for the personal motivation for Romanov to launch a coup. That and the fact that he firmly believed Gorbachev was taking the country down the wrong path in real life and in the blog. So that's pretty much the catalyst right there. Romanov comes in and seizes power, and he kind of starts to realize that things are a lot worse than he was under the impression they were. You know, things look a lot different from the outside. Once you're inside and you're in power, it's an entirely different vantage point. So that's when the road to war really started. Figure late spring 1987 in the blog world.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the way you've structured this thing. I'm fascinated by the fact you switched all over the world and you do it in segments. Can you kind of discuss how you've timed this out so you'll have part of it in the southern region, part of it in the northern area? I mean, how did you decide to do it that way?
Well, I gamed out the conflict, and the model for the conflict was set into theaters. Everything from the Central Front, Central Europe was the big one, Northern Flank, Baltic Approaches, Southern Flank, and even the peripheries, Western Pacific, you know, what's going on in Korea and on the Sino-Soviet border. That was all gamed out, and that was all just modeled and outlined, and they all came together. So the way I would set it up for each day, so let's say maybe D plus one, everything was set in each theater, and I would just kind of go through that and present that with, you know, really there was really no, in the beginning there was no set structure to how I presented it, because to be honest, I wasn't sure how long the blog was going to last. So I just kind of, you know, took it and ran with it, so to speak, again. But as time went on, I kind of started to structure it a little more. You know, the important events were discussed. The unimportant events, I just tried to minimize with maybe a sentence or two here and there. And as time went on, predictably, the Central Front became, you know, the core of the entire war and the blog. So that's what a lot of people were interested in. They were showing the most interest and fascination with that. I got more comments for the Central Front than probably any other theater. So
when you consider how many people actually served there, I can see that, you know, as part of the, you know, mentioning all the towns and things like that. And I'm curious because the writing is refreshingly consistent for something that's been written over the course of 5 years. And the rhythm and the style, it's very consistent. And I'm curious, and I'm sure some of it has to do with the fact that, like any blog or writing, early on you have a smaller audience and it builds over time.
Right.
But especially in the last, I don't know, 60 days or so compared to 5 years ago, has there been what type of feedback have you gotten, and has that changed over time? Your readers, just based upon the feedback you get, whether it's emails or comments or stuff like that, do you see where their focus or their concerns or their interest have changed?
To a point, yeah. Overall, even from the beginning, I've gotten a lot of feedback from, as you said, guys who are stationed there, people who are stationed in those areas around that time frame. And I've also gotten a good amount of feedback from people who lived in those areas, especially in northern Germany. So I'm talking about some of these towns just getting totally crushed, you know, under Soviet tank treads. And they would kind of say, well, I lived in this on this street and at this time, and I would have been right in the middle of it. And they kind of gave me a little bit of a insight as to what their life would have been like, you know, what their experience would have been if they had been there and if this had actually happened, you know, real time. So as far as the people who have served there, they've been really helpful and very supportive. They've offered a lot of just little tidbits of information about that time, especially 1987. I spoke to some people who were assigned to this 2nd Armored Division, their brigade up in northern Germany. And they gave me a little bit of insight as to what the war plans were, you know, what their defensive plans were, basically what they were expected to do, you know, if the balloon went up and the Russians crossed the border. So that was helpful. And I've also heard a lot from not only Americans, but just I've heard from a lot of British veterans and a lot of Danes. So I've got a good core of Danish readers who really have been very supportive of the blog, and they've given me a lot of information on the Danish Air Force, the Danish Army around that period of time, and that's been helpful. So,
I'd also say, you know, speaking of those people who live around there at that time, I had the pleasure of spending a couple of weeks at the Austrian Staff College in Vienna, and one of the interesting conversations we would have over drinks is we had a lot of Hungarians that were in the class with us and a couple other, you know, scattering, you know, a German here, an Italian there type of thing. These were all lieutenant colonels and colonels. And it was fun to sit there, and I asked if they do it in English. I couldn't follow them in German. But the Hungarians were talking about, when I was a captain, my company of tanks was designed to go through this valley. And you're talking to his Austrian counterpart, and they weren't NATO, but they knew they were going to be part of any conflict. They said, yeah, I was the anti-tank company commander, and they would talk about wargaming each other. So I'm curious, especially now that most of the Warsaw Pact and some of the Soviets are now inside our lifeline, so to speak, have you gotten any feedback from some of those people?
I've spoken to a couple of former East Germans who were in the East German Army around that time, and a couple of Poles, too. The Polish folks who have chimed in, they really like the fact that in the blog, Poland kind of just broke away from Russia. You know, Poland is kind of simmering in a revolution right now, and they gave me some insight to that, and they really believe that would happen, too. So that was nice to see. But as far as the East Germans go, yeah, they pretty much said that, you know, they expected to be dead within the first hours of the conflict. You know, they were set down in the Central Army Group area, CENTAG. You know, they were opposite, the West German Corps down there. And they were pretty much told right from the beginning, your life is going to be measured in hours, you know, from the time that hostilities start. So, and they said that they accepted it. That was something that was just really accepted by, you know, them, their NCOs, their officers. They had a mission to do, and the mission was first and foremost a priority. So it's kind of strange to see that mindset. you know, you hear about it a lot, especially with regards to the Eastern Bloc forces, but it was pretty true. That's how they were. That's how they thought. You know, that was their collective mindset.
Well, I'm always amazed. I mean, I'm older than some people out there who we talk to, but the attitude of a lot of people during the Cold War, especially the early Cold War, when my dad was flying for SAC, was that they didn't expect to come home. I mean, it was. So I'm not surprised at the people on the front line. My father-in-law was a tank unit commander in the Fulda Gap and some of the other
there
areas
you
discuss in your book. So, you know, that generation of guys went through the mindset that you're talking about. And I think it's important that people know that, you know, that exists. Now, one of the questions I have about writing alternative history and doing the research you're doing is, what do you see as the benefit of doing this? I mean, I'm glad you're amusing yourself and us by letting us read this, but is there something to be learned from doing from reading alternative history and thinking about what could have been?
I do. I definitely think that if the alternative history is done right and written right, you could learn a lot from that particular time period in history. And maybe you could have a little more respect for it and just realize how close things may have really come to taking that, you know, that alternate route where, you know, instead of the Berlin Wall falling in 1989, it could have been Russian tanks storming into West Germany 2 years earlier. You know, if not for a couple of events, you know, going one way instead of another, that could very easily have happened. So, yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of value in alternative histories, again, if they're done right. But I guess I should also say, too, that just the research and everything that's involved in, you know, bringing an alternative history, whether it's a blog or a novel or whatever, to bring that to life, you know, you learn a lot. So it's a very educational experience. I learned a lot more than I really ever bargained for once I started the research. I mean, I thought I knew a lot. I thought I was pretty up on Cold War military history and things like that, but I've just learned so much. And I try to put that into some of my other blog, especially now with what's going on in Eastern Europe.
Well, let's pull a thread on that. You know, when you started this in 2017, you know, and you progress along and you're continuing to go, you know, what are those things that you learned or areas you thought you understood where in the course of doing the research and creating the storyline, your opinion or point of view changed? And were there some areas that you just really weren't aware of that was really a revelation that you discovered while doing the research?
Right. I would say the one area that really I learned the most about is the difference between doctrine in theory and doctrine in action. The wargaming part of things really helped with that as far as air land battle on the Army side and the Navy's maritime strategy. When you look at the doctrine, it's all on paper, everything is neat and all, but once you start trying to put it into play, even in a simulation setting, you start to learn some of the advantages, some of the disadvantages, and just how realistic some of the things would be. For example, the Navy's maritime strategy. A big part of that was going after the Russian ballistic missile submarines, you know, their bastion up in up north in the Barents Sea, in the White Sea. That's all well and good, but to actually try to do that, well, once the shooting starts, it takes a lot more. And I kind of appreciate that a little more now. You know, the Navy had to go north. They had to secure the air and the sea around northern Norway. They had to knock back the Kola Peninsula. They had to deal with the backfires. And then once all that was said and done, then they could go in and start going after the missile subs. That's not easy. So I kind of learned a lot there as far as how difficult that would really be.
Did you find it difficult to separate, or do you find it difficult to separate your past as an Air Force officer in the way you write this? I mean, I know that I keep finding myself thinking, well, we must have had a lot more airplanes than I remember in 1987 because, you know, they just keep popping up everywhere. Is there some kind of detectable bias in your writing toward an Air Force scenario?
Maybe to a point there is, yeah. We had a pretty big, sizable Air Force back in 87, and we had plans on the books to move as much as we could from the continental U.S. over to Europe as fast as we possibly could. So I think that when I was looking at those plans and I was trying to bring that into reality as far as it would, what it would really be like, you know, there may have been a little more bias there. You know, the kind of the cavalry comes and saves the day. So air superiority is achieved. But I don't think that anything – that's not really outside of the realm of possibility because we did have a much better NATO air forces overall were superior to the Pact. But the Russians and their allies just had a lot more numbers. So it was interesting to go and actually start to put that to the test in simulations and kind of see how that would work out. But so, yeah, there may have been a little bit of a bias.
It leads into, you know, an interesting – you know, kind of a thought project because, you know, you look at from 87 to 2022, that's 35 years. And if you look at the 35 years prior to that, that would have been 1952 to 1987. I'm old enough. I remember 1987 very well. It was a great year. And you look at today at 2022, especially if you're going through the blog, you realize that a lot, especially on the Russian side, a lot of the equipment and in the U.S. side is the same. You know, we don't have, well, a couple of our allies still have F-4s tooling around. But besides that, you've got a lot of the same equipment. Of course, geography doesn't change. Weather doesn't change. The essence of chance doesn't change all that much. And I know especially in the last few months, the research and the things that you've realized while, you know, you're just talking about resupply and numbers, when you look at what's happening right now, whether on the Russian side or as U.S. and NATO starts to move things around, what are the things have you, you know, pointing at the TV or the computer screen and, you know, doing the Leonardo DiCaprio meme thing, going, that right there. You know, what really that's happening right now just makes you flash to the challenges that you saw looking at 1987?
It's amazing. Excuse me. You know, when I look back at 1987, I realized that the Army had pretty much 2.5 corps already stationed in Europe. They were armor heavy, and they had the reforger sites so they could bring in, you know, multiple divisions, bring the troops in, mate them up with the equipment. And they'd be available, you know, hopefully within a matter of days once the shooting starts. Fast forward to 2022, and we've got maybe, just in numbers at least, a division's worth of equipment in Europe. And that's pretty much just not going to do it. We've got one striker brigade, one airborne brigade. And in Poland, I think we have there's a heavy brigade that they rotate the troops in every so often. And, you know, even if we would go back maybe 20 or 22 years ago, maybe to around 2000, we had two heavy brigades in Germany, and they would really come in pretty handy right now instead of bringing in 18th Airborne Corps, you know, small numbers of 82nd Airborne Troops and all of that. So even though back then we had a lot of plans on the books to reinforce Europe rather quick, we just don't have that now, and we're seeing – you know, how much of a fallback that is, how much of a disadvantage that is. The Russians are putting 100,000 plus troops on their borders, and they're doing it pretty quick. And we just can't counter that right now. We've got nothing there to even hold the line until we can reinforce Europe. And then it becomes a question of, well, what do we reinforce Europe with? then the Navy comes into the plans. You know, you're going to might have to have a convoy system because the Russians still have some submarines. And there's just a whole number of variables to bring in. So it's interesting. Also, too, if I could – oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Oh, you finish your thought, please.
Sure. One big difference between 87 and 22 is the lack of a doctrine for our military, our armed forces, and NATO overall. Like I said back then, the primary doctrine for the U.S. Army in Europe and for NATO, really, because they were, you know, they were there too, was Air-Land Battle 2000. There's really no doctrine or no defensive plan, you know, to defend Europe from a threat from the East. And unfortunately, we're seeing that in some other areas too. There's really nothing for the Pacific either, and there's no excuse for that because we really should have seen what's happening there now. We should have seen that coming a long time ago. And it's just one of those shoulda, coulda, woulda things that might turn around to bite us in the rear one day pretty soon.
You're preaching to the choir. I think Sal and I have been discussing the issues with China for several years on on this podcast, and a lot of other issues. I mean, you're in your. I know one of the things I kind of take what's the right word? I just found it interesting. Your ability to, in your blog, to get the convoys operating, I think maybe by day 9 or 10 or something, if even that long. You know, that and it assumes a certain quantity of sea lift and a certain quantity of, I mean, this is 1987, and maybe we had it then. I don't remember, although, I should remember. I was working in convoy world in those days. Well, there was in the reserve. I went to the reserves, the Naval Control of Shipping Organization.
Oh, there you go.
Which now is something else. Was all in the reserves. So yeah, we got to play with that stuff, and you know the reforger exercises and all that stuff. I mean, I think we tried one of those recently. I don't remember how that went, but
I assume it took a while.
It's a problem, and that is one of those things. Now Byron points out in the chat room that Desert Storm showed us that we had a problem in 1990, 1991 with sea lift, and we added some equipment to help ease that. But you'd think we would have learned that we would need that capacity if we're going to do anything like reinforce Europe again or do anything in China. Now, so that being said. And I guess that's one of the things we should be taking a lesson from your work here. What are your thoughts on you just gave a lot of them, sea lift and then sustainment of the forces. I mean, that's the other thing you deal with, logistics. Those are important issues.
Yeah. Our sea lift capacity has really gone. I mean, you guys know it as well as I do, probably even more so. It's really gone downhill. So if we have to reinforce Europe very fast, it's not going to be done in a matter of days or even a couple of weeks. We're talking probably months to get those ships together, get the convoys together, and get them moving. And it could be an opposed crossing. There's no guarantee that it's going to be just a pleasure cruise across the Atlantic. So I don't know how much that's being taken into consideration in places like Newport or down in Washington. So I think that's one of those areas that definitely deserves a little more attention. As far as the Pacific goes, that's even a bigger problem. You know, the Pacific's a big ocean. So if we're talking about getting, troops and equipment from places like Hawaii and the West Coast over to maybe Korea and areas like that, it's going to be a challenge, to say the very least. And it'll definitely be opposed over there. You know, in Europe, there is maybe the possibility, in the Atlantic, I should say. But once you're getting into the Western Pacific nowadays, it's going to be an opposed crossing. So we really have to start preparing for that. I don't know if we are, to be honest.
I think it gets really scary really fast when you, math is hard, Mapped in wartime's harder when you look at numbers and availability. Mm-hmm. I know we've had, and I know he's listening to the show right here, so perk your ears up a little higher. Sal Mercogliano, we've had him and John Conrad from G Captain on as well, talking about that exact challenge of an opposed crossing. And it's very frightening when you see some of the assumptions the U.S. Navy side of the house had towards some of the very few numbers of logistics ships that if the National Command Authority decides we need to reinforce Europe or reinforce the Pacific, and you can only get material there effectively one way, that's by sea, when you talk about an opposed crossing, you get maybe half a step into a war game, and things get really scary really fast. And I like how you said, you know, people haven't really, you know, thought about it. And I think that's one of the great values of what you've done the last half decade on looking at 87, because there are things that definitely translate here and today. And one thing I wanted to pull the thread on you, because when we look at what's happening in Europe right now, everybody's talking conventional, and that's great, and that's fine. And I've always looked at it that if we're lucky, the next conflict that comes to Europe, it will someday, you know, that's just what history tells us, that you know, hopefully nuclear weapons will be to that what chemical weapons were in the Second World War. But there's one scenario that on the naval side of the house that I believe it's about D plus 11 and D plus 10 you start writing about, is when NATO does what NATO will have to do, which is to go into Russia proper to hit logistics, hit air bases, and things of that manner, we put something the Russians value as much as we do, and that's our strategic deterrent and the ballistic missiles and going out to sea. And as an Air Force guy, even Navy guys who haven't looked at it, as an Air Force guy, as you looked at, especially when you read the 1986 maritime strategy and what that plan is, talk a little bit, you know, about even today, because wars have started for more stupid reasons and less logical reasons than anything that's happening right now, so I don't discount anything. In contemporary means, what are the lessons you learned about that particular aspect of the Russians' view of their strategic deterrence, safety in port versus at sea, and how, if things go sideways, people should think about that in the back of their head?
That's pretty interesting. You know, in port, those strategic assets are really nothing more than targets. If you take those boomers and they're tied up to the quay, you know, they're very vulnerable to air attack or, you know, a bunch of other very unpleasant possibilities. Once they're out in the sea and they're up in the bastion, they're protected. They've got minefields. They've got attack subs. They've got, you know, ASW groups mounted all up there to protect them and to keep them viable. So I think that's something that, you know, for Russia and even for the United States, you know, our power really comes from our ability to make war. And our nuclear weapons, pretty much the last line of defense, you know, without those, that's it. We're pretty much like, we're not a superpower. So in the blog, the Russians recognized that pretty early on. And they let that be known to the U.S. and NATO. We're flushing our subs out. Don't attack them. You know, any attack against them is going to bring on a similar response. So, you know, there have to be limits in any conflict. You know, you can't just go buck wild in the Russians' backyard and target their, you know, a big part of their nuclear forces and expect them to just kind of roll over and take it. It's not going to happen. So nowadays, though, yeah, I really think that, I hope that, you know, nuclear weapons are just going to be taboo in any future conflict. You know, I really can't see in any scenario NATO making first use of nuclear weapons, you know, whether it's to stop the Russians from overrunning Poland or even, you know, taking over half of Germany. I just don't think that the alliance is united enough to, you know, even consider making those decisions. And we can't make that decision on our own, as much as we might like to. So So, you know, there's a lot of food for thought there.
Well, I'd say the French might be tempted to nuke part of Germany to protect themselves from Russia, but that just goes back to old wars. I had a great question that I blew it by trying to be funny.
That was good.
It had to do with the motivation behind Romanov's. Well, I mean, maybe I missed it in some part of the blog I didn't read. What is driving Russia or the Soviet Union in 87 to drive into Europe after all the years they didn't do anything?
Well, like I mentioned before, Romanov and the hardliners, their attitude, you know, in Blog World 1987 is pretty similar to what, you know, the hardliners felt in 1991 when they actually tried a coup. As far as what got them to the point where they actually decided to, you know, start a war, they realized that the Soviet Union was a declining power. And every day that went by declined that power even more. And even more important, every day that went by made NATO stronger. 1987 was a point in time when we were going from equality with probably the Warsaw Pact to superiority. Our new weapons were coming online in pretty good numbers. The attitude in Europe had really changed, and you see that with Operation Desert Storm. The army that went into the Saudi desert to defend it and then to liberate Kuwait, that was the same army that was going to be tagged with saving Europe from, you know, from a Russian attack. And it was probably the most – probably the best army we've ever put into the field. And I think the Russians recognized that to an extent, and they realized that if they were going to move, they had to move immediately. Otherwise, the collapse of the Soviet Union was pretty much going to be imminent. As we saw in the real world, that's actually what came about a few years later.
I guess one thing that's kind of hard to war game, especially in the real world, because you could hurt people's feelings and national pride, is the fact that when you do a lot of war games, a body is a body, a plane is a plane. This nation's mechanized infantry brigade has the same capabilities as that nation's infantry brigade. And you know, we talked a little bit about one thing that led you, and I won't spoil it for those that haven't started reading the World War III blog yet, but the Polish army does something that you can very easily connect through actual real and historical effects, the fact that that starts to impact the Warsaw Pact's actions. When you're looking at NATO forces and, you know, what we called in other locations, national caveats or traditions or way of fighting wars. How did you look at that and try, if you could, to impact your writing? Because it's not all U.S. versus Russia. You've got the Belgian army, the Dutch, the both Germans,
right.
The Danes. You have the terror. I like the fact that you brought in some of the scenarios. The territorial armies, what we would call the reserves and the National Guard, that true today, but especially true back then for some of those nations, was a substantial part of their warfighting capability.
Right, it really was. And you know, for all those countries, all those nations that you mentioned, Holland, Denmark, Belgium, well, maybe not so much Denmark, but at least as far as Germany is concerned, they all had a role to play. And those reserve formations were included in a lot of NORTHAG's war plans. So they had a role, and they had a place at the table, so to speak. So it really wasn't that hard to bring them in. Sometimes they would come in as replacements. Once in a while, they would come onto the line as just fresh units, you know, intact, and have to take on, you know, the Soviet attack. It's really a lot different than the way a lot of those countries look at their reserves nowadays. Some of them kind of look at it as filler. Some of them look at their reserves pretty much as pretty much tailor-made for non-combat roles. So very different from the way it was in 1987. So it was definitely easier to bring them into the fight in the blog than I think it would be if I was going to do a blog set in contemporary times in Europe. You know, it just wouldn't have the same impact.
Yeah, one other question I had was about mine warfare. I'm questioning about mine warfare at sea. I notice you have a lot of mine laying going on in your blog, but I don't recall, and maybe I just missed it, much mine sweeping. Mostly, I think you had some point where somebody's subs, probably the Russian subs, were looking, trying to figure if they could figure out the pattern of the mine laying countries minefield.
Yeah, that was in the Baltics, around Denmark and all. They were trying to kind of thread their way through. Honestly, mine sweeping and mine countermeasures is not a topic I'm up on. And I tried to do some research in it, and it was just like the more that I researched and the more that I learned, the more complex it became. So I just tried to keep it as simple and as, you know, as light as I could. So,
well, bless you for
that.
Your answer. No, bless you for your answer. It is it's extremely complicated and extremely time consuming, and a lot of people don't.
Yeah, it really is.
Some of the war games I've been involved in, people just assume it away rather than thinking, well, you know, we're going to spend a couple of weeks or more trying to figure out where these things are. So,
right, exactly. It's not easy.
Yeah, I just want to double down on that. I think your answer is perfect. And that's one of the lessons that people can take away, and obviously you've taken away, is when you look at since World War II, what has hurt the U.S. Navy more than anything else, it's been mines, and dumb mines at that.
Yeah,
and,
very true.
Still an active duty officer, been a guest of the show, friend of the show as well, Matt Hipple. He's actually over in Europe, and everybody can either be reassured or frightened, depending on how much they know Matt. He's going to wind up being one of the U.S. Navy's experts on mine warfare when he gets through in Zeebrugge and the NATO mine command there that he's at. It is real complicated, especially when you like you said, when you start researching it and then you realize what the capabilities of mining are versus the capability of getting rid of the mines. There's been a... landmines have been looked at a lot, but taken care of in theory by some treaties, but sea mines is a whole different matter altogether.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to ask you, because it's something that, we don't have to get into current details, I'll speak in very broad terms. There's been a lot of questions the last few years when there have been failures and shortcomings in the U.S. military that senior leaders just don't seem to get fired. They'll relieve a commander, lieutenant colonel, captain colonel for a bad command climate survey, but you can have huge problems and there are no relieving of flag officers, which hasn't always been true in the U.S. military. We have kind of a great tradition of firing incompetence, giving people a chance to recover, and they can come back later. But both on in your World War III 1987 blog, on both the Soviet side and the U.S. side, you know, inside the 2 weeks of war, you have leaders on both sides looking at performance and do I need to relieve this commander or I am relieving this commander. What were some of the historical examples you looked at is why, you know, people at the pull mill level will look at their four stars, or their four stars will look at their three stars, or the three stars will look at their two stars and go, you're not doing it. Go, I'm going to have somebody else come in and we're going to do it better, and how quickly that can actually occur.
I think historically, we can go back to World War II. Anybody who's seen the movie Patton, you know, realizes that when he came into North Africa, he was brought in as a replacement for a commander there who just wasn't getting the job done. I think that guy, that commander's name was Friedendahl, I believe. But he suffered the first army defeat of the war, the first U.S. defeat of World War II. Well, army, yeah, at Kasserine Pass. So defeat is going to definitely send a general packing. There's just no way around it. In the blog, and not to spoil it for anybody, but at one point, the American an American general, in this case it was General Galvin, who was the commander back in 1987, he relieved the commander of the Northern Army Group, who was British, and that caused some political issues that the fallout was really just starting to come into the blog now. I'm starting to write about it a little more. But, you know, that's one aspect of, you know, alliances that you have to look at. If a commander from one nation is going to be relieving, you know, from nation A is going to relieve a general from nation B, there's going to be political fallout. So I think that that's something that maybe a lot of people don't look at. They don't maybe recognize that that's going to be a major factor, but it can be. Even nowadays, you know, especially in NATO, because the climate is nowhere near as united as we would like it to be. So I don't know if they'd be able to do that nowadays, especially nowadays, because, you know, there's a political, domestic and, you know, foreign policy. Politics play a big role in military decisions, maybe more so now than in the last 30, 40 years. So I hope that answers it.
Well, it does. There was an interesting situation during the Kosovo affair where Royal Army General refused to play with what was his name?
Jackson. General Jackson.
Yeah, Jackson.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wouldn't. He didn't want to start World War III, apparently. So.
Even looking at Kosovo, Wesley Clark. You know, he was fired right in the middle of the war. He was the Supreme Commander. I mean, you just don't see that happening at all. That's one of those instances where it just, you know, the ramifications could have been huge. They weren't, thank God, but, you know, to take a senior general officer out and remove him in the middle of a conflict, that's pretty much unprecedented.
Well, so. We've seen it recently with Petraeus and you know, and a couple of others in the Afghan excitement.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're getting near the end of the show, Mike, and I wanted to make sure that we ask you. You've got a couple of books coming out, I understand. What else are you working on? You got this blog. You got the other blog. What? Tell us about what you're up to, and when we can start seeing these other things.
Well, if it wasn't for the current crisis in Ukraine, I'd be looking at a book release in about a week or so. And I just want to note, too, that in my bio, I put a typo in there. It was summer of 21 when I signed the book deal, not summer of 2019. That would be dragging it out a little too much.
I can fix that.
No problem. Thanks. That book is on the shelf right now because of what's happening in Europe. If the Russians do jump at some point, and I think they will, there's really going to be no point in releasing a book that's, you know, set on a war with Russia 35 years ago. And I understand where the publishers are coming from with that. So we're working on book number two right now, which is a U.S.-China war. I just wrapped up the outline with that, and I'm starting to get into the deeper drafts. One of my researchers, Byron, he's helping me out with that on the research side. He's going to be getting some work pretty soon. But that's first and foremost right now. So we'll see how fast we can get that done and get that out. So,
well, when even the Bush publishers are looking kind of darkly here at our winter and spring, that's not a very encouraging thing.
Very true.
You know, Michael, we definitely got to keep in touch, especially when your book about China comes out. We'd love to talk to you about that because it's as – my co-host and I, you know, we talk to folks all the time, and we need more people thinking, more people talking. I think that helps everybody see things a lot better. And I'd highly encourage the listeners, if you want to get a feeling for that the publisher decided that the president might put it on an off-ramp. If you haven't already, go to the blog there at the link for World War 1987. It's a great read, and the way Michael has it structured, you can do like I mentioned in the beginning, just keep those tabs over on the left side of your web browser, and you can chew on it a little bit every day, just like turning the page. You've done a great job. It's really interesting. And it goes, how can I say this heading out the door here? Without insulting our friend, Mr. Clancy, there's a lot of fingertip detail and fidelity in the way this is written. If you've worn the uniform or you're just a geek who's been reading about it your whole life since you're 10 years old, especially if you've done both, it's a real great read, because a lot of times people don't get into that type of granularity that you can feel at the fingertips. So it's a great read. Great job, Michael. Good long-term benefit, and we're looking forward to reading more as you push out with your books.
Excellent. Sounds good. Guys, thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed this. And, yeah, I've listened to the blog a lot. The podcast, I'm sorry. I love the podcast. So definitely have to stay in touch. And, maybe down the line, maybe we could talk China a little bit, talk Taiwan, South China Sea, and see where it goes from there.
Perfect. It'd be great. Look forward to it.
All right. Sounds good.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope you all have a great Navy Day and Air Force Day, too, for Michael. Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame.